The Bain Free Radio Hour.
Hello and welcome to the Bain Free Radio Hour. Today, Sean Hazlett finishes up his interview with anthology editors Casey Azell, David Boop, Jamie Ibsen, and Jason Cordova, discussing the construction of anthologies from idea to final book. After that, we'll have more One Jump Ahead by Mark L. Van Name, Part 56.
Friendship. So I make friends and I make them my bagmen. And then when a problem, when a problem arises, I reach out. Be like, hey, man, need a solid.
What I've done in the past is my, it would be great to have this person and I know that they would turn in a great story, but they will probably say no. They get the invites first. And then once I know how many of my high end, this person, has an established body of work and is going to, unquestionably be on the cover. Once they've turned me down, then I have my standbys, my reliables, my people who would absolutely be keen to do it. And
I skipped that step. I do that too, right? Like when, we invited Jim Butcher to be in the noir anthologies and he was like, I would love to, I can't, it's too, I'm too busy. And so we had, sorry, Jamie, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Fine, he said yes to me, though.
Well, that's because he likes you better, David. Clearly, you're a better editor than me.
There we go. But yeah, basically, I build it in steps. And then the trick is just to keep herding cats and sending reminders. And I didn't think that I would need to pad the due date for plausibly denial. I'm like, I'm sure we'll have it in by the end of February and I can have the manuscript done, 2 weeks later and send it in. And then it's like middle of May. And
lessons
I'm like,
were learned.
Hey, so I'm waiting on you, sir. And he's like, oh, right. I'll get back to you. I'm like, oh my God. One of the things that I didn't do for Plausibly Deniable that I've done in the past is I actually will use a privatized Facebook group to tag in all of the authors because I will not do slush. I will not do anything other than invite only. And I want to know who I'm working with before we say yes. So then, for my previous anthologies, it's been, hey, everybody, welcome to the working group for such and such a title. I will tag everybody and I will be putting updates here in this group. If you're not using Facebook like more than once a week, then I'll email you if you really want. But this is the easiest way for me to blast the same messaging out to everybody because it works. And I didn't do that for Plausibly Deniable and I probably should have, but whatever. We got it done.
Yeah, my coefficient is 1.25. I invite 12, 1.25 times the number of slots that I have because 30% will always fail. And I de-risk everything. I don't have time to, to be your dad. Go ahead, David.
Oh, I'd say so far I've only had a couple of issues with people flaking. The biggest one was the Wellworld anthology/mosaic novel that I just did for Ark Manor. I lost two headliners and, their schedules didn't account for it apparently. And they just finally said, nope, can't do it. And when you're scrabbling for headliners, that becomes more difficult. Than just I need to fill a hole for a mid-lister or a new voice as we're defining them. But the Wellward was specifically difficult because we were trying to make sure we found people who had read Midnight at the Well of Souls, was familiar with Jack Chalker's worlds, liked Jack, because there was a couple of people that turned down invites because they just didn't like him. I can write you a story, but I didn't like him while he was alive. I'm not going to support him while he's dead.
Like the opposite of the power
with
of spite.
That. What's that?
That's the opposite of the power of spite.
Yeah. And so I was able to do it, but the anthology got turned in almost a year late because I had one replace them. that one flaked and I had to replace that one. And that person was in a completely different side of the world. And so communicating them with them was kind of difficult because they were always on a different timeline. And they were doing things like writing symphonies for the Olympics and feature films and things like that, you know.
As one does.
So kind of a big name in Asia, but not as big here anymore. But was a dear friend of Jack's and wanted and produced the story I wanted him to produce. And it was just, but it just threw everything off. And but for normally I have a list of alternatives. And I talk to those people to say, hey, listen, I can't give you an invite right now, but I've got this anthology, and if somebody falls out, you're my first alternate author. And they're always appreciative to even be considered for it. And if there's a volume two, then they get the invite first. So yeah.
I'm kind of like Casey, where I'm just kind of like, I know I have 10 stories. I need 10 people. Well, I need 10 stories. Might not always get 10 people. Sometimes I'll get 12 because there'll be collaborators. I've been kind of cursed, though, with every single anthology. My headliner, or at least one of my two headliners, has dropped out of every single anthology I've done, which is a little irritating. I understand, like, time. I've said no to anthologies as well. I foolishly said no to noirs, Casey's noir, because I didn't know what noir was at the time. Once she explained to me later, I was like, oh, that's noir? She's like, yes, you stupid. That's what I was like, I know what noir
I
is.
never called you stupid. I would
No,
never say that
it
to
was
you.
implied
I
though.
would never say that to
You were
you.
very sweet
Maybe by
about
you.
Well, Jason, Google is your friend, and now AI is your friend. So, but back then they didn't really have AI, so.
Skynet is the enemy. We've been killing an awful lot of
Anyways.
Automatons and Helldivers. They're not the friend.
Well, and I had to bail on Jason on his latest anthology, and I felt horrible about it. And
You're
I shouldn't have
a
said yes.
replacement for somebody else who bailed, though, so it's okay.
Yeah, I know. And I feel bad about that, especially. It's just, you know, sometimes we want we're kids in candy stores, right? Like all the stuff that we have to do, anthologies or novels or short fictions for our own things. It's like you want to do it all because it all sounds so good. And
Casey and I were talking about this earlier today, actually.
this morning on
yeah,
Twitter or X or whatever
yeah. And
it
then
was.
like your health takes a turn or something like that, which was my case. My writing went back down to only a couple hours a day, where I had finally gotten it back up to about 6 hours, and then it dropped back down to two, and there was just too much to do, and I felt bad about that. But Jason handled it very well. He was very professional about it. He didn't yell at me and make me cry. I thought he would. I really did.
I know.
I cried.
I'm scared to write for a Sean anthology now, because if I
Oh,
flake, he's
there's
gonna
no
be like, "You're dead to
yelling.
me."
There's no yelling. There's just a deathly silence that never ends. Keep in mind, I'm a Scorpio, and that's just the
It'd
way
be
that
so much easier
we
if you
work.
just yell at me.
You
Mean, I
don't want that either.
cried,
You
but
don't
that
want
was
the Irishman to come
myself.
out. Yeah, you don't want.
I just say I'm very disappointed in you. It's just.
I will go to my room and think about this, Jason. You know I
I
will.
would like to clarify something here, though, too, is that, for any of the writers who are watching this and who are feeling the pressure of, like, shit's going down and, like, you have this thing but you can't do it or whatever, there is a difference between reaching out like a professional and owning up and being like, hey, I need an extra week or two, or I can't make this happen right now because, my kid's in the hospital or whatever it is, right? There is a difference between doing that and just going radio silent, right? One, radio silence is flaking, it's unprofessional, and it's unkind. None of those things are good, right? Reaching out and communicating, that's what a professional does. And the truth is, there's, in terms of writers, I'm convinced there's those that have and those that will. It's inevitable at some point because life be lifin',
Yeah, let me
Yeah,
operationalize you
the
for
number one
that.
tempo author that we had for
Yeah.
Plausibly Deniable, was telling me the whole way along, yes, I'm going to get you a story. I'm busy with this mega project and it's going to take up a bunch of time and I will get it to this. And then we get to the point where he expected to have the story in, and he's like, yeah, so my publisher just reached out to me, and I can't. And we were already a month and a half past due date at that point. And shucks, gosh darn, we got Jodie Lynn Nye to fill that slot, right? Like that ended up working out
Oh,
pretty okay.
no. Oh,
But
she will write a short story for you. Boom, like
yeah,
that.
she's
She's Oh yeah.
fantastic. She's
I
been amazing
see her at
for
cons
is
going around.
tremendous.
Yeah. Oh, she's amazing. She'll go around the cons. Why haven't you invited me to an anthology lately? Why haven't you invited me to an
Oh,
anthology lately?
no. So, David, it was Dragon Con. I'm at home. I get a FaceTime from Jodie Lynn Nye. I'm like, oh, hi, Jodie. How are Jason? I heard you're doing a chicks anthology. Oh, yes, ma'am. She's like, why haven't I been invited? I've written every single chicks anthology. I was like, and literally, my headliner, besides David Drake, had dropped out the day before. So her timing was fortuitous because I was scrambling. And I was like, well, the deadline's kind of passed, but she's like, when do you have to turn it in by? Because Jody knows the game. She's been around long enough to know when the editors have their deadlines. So I told her, she's like, I will have your story to you a week before then. And she gave me a fantastic story. But yeah, just out of the blue, she called me and invited herself to my anthology. And I was like, yeah, sure. I
And her
love that. That
work,
was great.
this is one of the
Good problem to
amazing
have.
things about having somebody like a Jodie Lynn Nye. They'll turn it in, and there may be a comma out of place, and that's about it. And she'll
Very
probably
clean.
set that comma if you
Knocks it right out
suggest
of the
it.
park.
It is, it, yeah, she turns in crisp, clean stuff, which is an editor's dream, right? So.
Which was the same with Laurel K. Hamilton, honestly, when we did the noir anthologies. Her stories were they came in the last, right? They were within the deadline, but they came in last. I mean, what am I going to do? The woman's writing Anita Blake and Mary Gentry. I'm not going to like nag her about things. But it was fine because the minute that I got that first story for her for the first volume, she was in all three. I was like, I don't have to touch this like at all. There was zero editing to be done. And so it was cool, right? Like, I was like, okay, this is a clean story. I don't have to mess around with, edits back and forth. It's like, cool. Include it in the manuscript, send it,
And that's an important point,
That's great.
Casey. Yeah, that's important point Casey makes up is that these people are also writing novels. And Kevin J. Anderson, who has mentored me for years, put it in the perspective of money for me because he's a businessman. He knows how to make money. And he said, when I write a novel, there is a an hourly rate that I have in my mind. I'm going to make this much off of this novel, and it comes down to a word rate, right? Just like short fiction, but it's for novels. He says, when I write a short story for somebody, I'm already losing money before I start writing it because I'm doing it as a favor for you or as a promotional tool or whatever. And he's like, so you can't pay me enough to make up the time I'm losing writing novels. Okay, valid. He says, then when you send me edits, that lowers that per word rate even more. So I will fix some typos and punctuation, or if I, if I miss something big, great. But I'm not doing rewrites. I am not doing developmental edits. He goes, when you ask for a New York Times best-selling author, you're buying their name more than you're buying the content of the story. And that has a value to you as well. But I countered with him. I says, yeah, but my name's on the book, and I want every one of those stories to be perfect, within the theme and so forth. And what he had missed in his story was that it didn't take place in the Old West, and it was a weird Western. And I said, can you have a flashback to the Old West? And he said, sure. And he wrote it, and he goes, yeah, I wrote it, and you're right, it made the story better, but I hated you for like 6 months afterwards because you lowered my per word rate on that short story by making me go back and rewrite something. So most times I haven't had to do that with authors, especially the headliners. But I think about that also for the writers who might be listening too, is make sure your story is as absolutely as perfect as it can be when you send it to them, because you also are working for a word count, word rate, and stuff like that. So, yeah.
David raises an interesting point. So, have you, any of you, ever had a scenario where the story comes in egregiously late and it's just, it's not a disaster,
But they
but
misunderstood the assignment.
no, but it's like a rework, but they don't have, you don't have time for the back and forth. So, in the edit, you do kind of like a developmental edit, like David was kind of saying, and because you just have to, like, you don't have time to find a replacement. What's the fine line between when you just send it back and say no, or you just kind of roll up your sleeves and fix it and then send it back to the author and say, hey, bro, like, if you want to be in this anthology, you know, like, what do you think first? And usually they'll say, oh, yeah, it's much better. But how do you handle those sorts of situations? They're very rare, but they do happen.
So I had invited somebody who had never written fiction before to one of my We Dare anthologies, and he sends me the story, and I'm like, so we have a problem, because the only thing that actually happens in your story is your guy signs a clipboard. Everything else is just memory flashback and like internal thought, and he was like, oh. And so I said, so here's what we're gonna do. You and me, I was still working my day job at the time. I said, we're going to take the next 4 evenings, and we are going to work on this thing from scratch. You know, this is my fault for inviting a guy who's never written anything before. So I'll wear half of it. But you got to be here as we fix this. And so we went back and forth, and we got rid of the flashback part altogether. The clipboard scene went in at the conclusion as like the almost an epilogue bit, but we turned it into a murder mystery. And then we get to the end, and he has put in, and learned more, in 4 evenings of a couple hours each evening, working on getting the story tuned up, until I was like, okay, cool, I will accept this. And I'm going to drop an F-bomb, but his response was, oh, thank God. Fuck anyone who says writing is easy.
Very true.
And that, as far as I know, is the only thing he has ever written. So I mean, in that case, we took the bull by the horns, and thank goodness we both had time that we could carve out of our schedules. We were not so mercenary with our time in the way that that a professional might. And to be totally honest, I am probably not nearly mercenary enough with my time when it comes to this stuff, mostly because I'm not doing the writing because of the money. I spend way more on supporting my writing habit than I actually earn from it. So I'm not here to make bank. I'm
Did you
40
say
and
rude?
I'm in my 40s and I'm already retired, and I'm doing okay money-wise. The writing is something for me to make stuff. And so that's what I get out of it. The major rewrite stuff like that, it's either catastrophic enough that we can't save it, or I look for another way to use it, like I was hoping to do with the shore leave story with Jason, or we just, put the hours in to tune it up.
I didn't have that exact situation, but I did an anthology for Chris Kennedy Publishing set in the Four Horsemen universe that was themed around this one particular race of aliens that we had created. And we, by the time that the anthology was going out, the series had something like, I don't know, like 27 books in it. It's now up to over 100. It's ridiculous because it's a shared world. There's multiple people writing in it. And there was no way that I was going to, ask Jody Lynn Nye to read 27 books to write a short story for me, right? So I knew that some of the lore and world building that we had included in our books was probably not going to translate. So it's kind of in anticipation of that. I worked with my co-editor, Marisa Wolf, on this one, and we kind of came up with a frame narrative of, okay, what this collection is this is a collection of stories that these aliens tell themselves. And that frame narrative allowed us so much flexibility, right? Because it didn't have to match the world building lore. It's a story that they tell, you know?
Internal
And
myth.
yeah, exactly. Internal myth at play. And it worked beautifully, right? So I think sometimes if you depending on I mean because the true answer to your question, Sean, is it depends, right? Like it always depends. It's always an individual situation. But I think some projects you know going in it's going to be a little bit more prone to that because you know there's this wealth of world building Bible stuff and someone's going to miss it, right? So okay, figure out a way to make it plausible. To quote Jamie's anthology,
Yeah.
even if it doesn't fully match what's canon already.
Oh my God. And then, okay, so I'm going to jump in and talk about Freehold Resistance for a moment.
Okay. Oh
So
yeah. That was a great anthology. It came out
it was
great.
an awful lot of fun.
Yeah.
It's Mike's world. And what I had done, because I'm a little twitchy this way, is I really, really, really want to respect canon if I'm going to play in someone else's sandbox. And so I sat down and I read Freehold. I read The Weapon. I re read Angel Eyes. I read the short stories that Mike had published that were also in Freehold. And I created my own world Bible based on everything that I found on the pages inside the world. And then I pitched to Mike a book. I wanted to write what happened to the Leopard Corps after the war on Grania was won. And he was interested. I had no credentials. And so then I'd showed him the work that I'd done reading up on everything that he'd written. And then like a year and a half later, I'm all of 20,000 words into this novel, not having any idea what I'm doing. And then he reaches out to me and he says, "Hey, look, I'm going to do another anthology. We've already done Forged in Blood, the sword-based anthology where it stretches time-wise. That's cool. But I want to do an anthology that is set during the war. You still have that Bible kicking around?" So I ended up being Mike's, I'm trying to remember the acronym that he used, Vice Deputy Assistant Editor in Charge of Continuity and Stuff, I think was this absurd acronym that he came up with me in for me in the acknowledgments. And it was nuts because Mike was assessing the stories for theme and for quality and for all this kind of thing. And then he'd hand them to me and be like, "Figure out where this will fit into the timeline." A lot of the stories were based on like one paragraph that got mentioned, right? Jason wrote the Skywheel coming down story. That's one day when Kendra's out in the wilds and she looks over and there's like, the world's biggest meteor shower coming down. She's like, "Oh my God, they dropped Skywheel 3."
One
And so then,
line.
right? And so we were able to take little events that that pop up as background filler for the larger picture and turn them into these stories that that meant so much more. Mike's wife Jess is basically a professional white hat hacker herself. She developed an entire concept for how a mesh hacker network would work with individual tablets and devices being able to bounce signal encrypted through until they eventually reach their intended recipient, stuff like that. And then at the end, we get to the end of it, and the anthology reads like a coherent, chronologically written novel with 11 points of view, including the four stories that run from page one to page last. And one of the greatest compliments we got was in an Amazon review where it was like, "Whoever managed the canon and the continuity on this story I need to buy them a drink because I looked really hard to find something that didn't fit and I couldn't find one." And I was like, "Yes."
Yeah, you did a great
So,
job, Jamie.
and then Mike was like, "We're never doing this again. This was way too."
I had to build Bibles. I had to build Bibles for both Jack L. Chalker's Well World and Larry Niven's Gildearm Hamilton, which is the anthology I'm working on now. And I had to build those from scratch because nobody had ever done that before. And with Jack and Well World, he had, there's like 1,500 alien species on Well World, but only about 200 of them are mentioned. And I had to scour through PDFs to find mentions of all the different races and descriptions and what their hex is like, technology level and environment. And so I built this Bible, and that's just for Well World, because there's a whole nother universe outside of Well World that Jack was very loose with the continuity on. And I had to somehow rein all of that in too. We've talked about publishing the Bible because nobody has ever assembled all the Well World in one place like this. Obviously, with known space, there's a lot of wikis and things for Larry out there, but nothing that's Gil Hamilton focused. So again, having to scour through all the stories and talking with Larry about, well, what about this? And oh, this, you changed this later on. Why? To make all of that. But Bibles are really important because the author has to be able to say, if I have a question, is it in the Bible? If it's not in the Bible, is it fair game? Right? And so forth. So I've been handed Bibles for things like the Green Hornet that I had to go back and edit because there were continuity mistakes in there and so forth. So yeah, Bibles are important, but they also have to be 1,000% accurate if that's what your writers are going
Because
to base their stories on.
the fans will notice and they'll be offended, and you have to respect whatever material it is that you're coming from.
All right, we're running up
Especially,
against again.
I was just gonna say, especially if you're writing for gun guys or horse girls, and those are gender neutral terms.
Horse girls.
But do not, the only group worse than gun guys in terms of rivet counting are horse girls. Again, gender neutral.
Yeah, I have my people I call when I have questions on either.
I
So.
call the same people.
Yeah.
All right, we're running up on time here. So let's just go around the horn and just talk about kind of your latest project, your latest anthology or novel that's come out. And then we'll kind of end it from there. So let's start with you, Jamie.
So Plausibly Deniable comes out on March 3rd. It's an awful lot of fun. It has the first Buff Orpington story in it. I am editing the first Buff Orpington novel at the moment. Kayfabe re requires that I say nothing more about who Buff actually is or isn't. But when that book comes out, it will be the Buff or it will be Buff Orpington versus the League of Conspicuous Evil by Buff Orpington. And the plan at this point is to do a series of trilogies with genre hopping between each.
All right,
Sounds amazing.
Casey.
My most recent anthology that I edited was a couple years ago. It was Down These Mean Streets. It's the third in my trilogy of noir anthologies, co-edited with Larry Correia. However, March, what day? Seventh? Third? What day is this
Third.
coming out? Third.
Third.
March 3rd.
You're
I
in
have
both.
stories in two anthologies that are coming out on the same day, edited by these two gentlemen, which was a pleasure and so much fun. So, Plausibly
Question.
Deniable and then Monster Hunter Files. Yes.
Didn't you do an Ashes of Encinia anthology too recently?
Ashes of Encinia, yes. But that was Down These Mean Streets came out after that. But
Oh,
yes.
did he?
Yeah,
Oh.
I also have an anthology in with Chris Kennedy Publishing that is called Remnants of Empire, and my 12-year-old daughter has her first published story in that one. So I that's like
Horrendous.
the biggest selling point for that anthology. It's like, here, read my kid. So yeah.
Jason.
March 3rd, I'm my Monster Hunter anthology with Larry Correia comes out, and then I'm also in Plausibly Deniable as well with Casey and Jamie,
I'm just gonna hold them.
and then I just turned in my Chaos and Consequences anthology that's coming out this November to Tony. So that was a whew, that was a hard one. That was difficult because I had a lot of people back out, and I had to like. plug and pull and like reaching deep into the bench to grab people. And I just pretty much told Nick Stevenson to write what you want. Just make sure it's over 12,000 words, please, because I'm running up on my deadline and I need a story.
Yeah.
David?
So I mentioned Permutations, a well-world mosaic novel, which is basically kind of an anthology that is all interconnected, based on the works of Jack L. Chalker that came out just about a year ago, and we are still pimping that hard. Check out the videos that I've been posting on YouTube and so forth. We're taking the authors and we're morphing them into their characters, their alien characters. It's so much fun. And Catherine Asaro is our first. We turn her into a
Nice.
Sphinx like character. So
Nice.
definitely worth checking those out. The Green Hornet anthology I kickstarted last year for Moonstone is shipping as we speak. So those are finally going out, and then they'll be available retail shortly afterwards. And I'm doing an anthology for the New England horror writers as a favor. And I am about to, called Wicked West. And then the invites are going out real soon here for the Gil the Arm Hamilton anthology. Set in Larry Niven's known space world, including a brand new story from Larry and Steve, which will be our he headline story, plus Sacred Cow, which was published in Asimov's, I believe, will be reprinted for the first time in that. So and then I'm just working on my novels, Drowned Horse Volume 2. And I'm co-authoring two other novels with people. And so yeah, it's a busy time, but it's a lot of fun. I'm hitting across many spectrums. So yeah.
Excellent. And the one thing I did neglect to ask, again, just going around the horn, where can people find each of you? Your websites, YouTube channels, etc. Jamie.
My website is Ibsen Writes, all one word, ibsenwrites.ca. Because I'm the token frozen hoser, IBSON. Don't put an E in there, which most people try to. And then obviously Amazon. Everything that I write is on Amazon. I've got short stories up there as Kindle Unlimited downloads and stuff like that.
Casey?
So you can reach me at my website. It's caseyezell.net or .com. Either one works. I own both. In addition, if you are a creative person who is struggling with creative blocks or resistance, I just recently launched my course on how to use mindset and resilience tools that I learned in the military and then throughout my creative career to defeat creative resistance and push past blocks and not kill yourself doing so. So you can check that out. I've got information on all that on all my socials. So it's like X and Instagram and Facebook. And you can email me through my website if you want more information about that. So the first cohort for that starts March 1st, which I think is going to be after this airs, right? So it will open again in the
Excellent.
future. Yeah.
Jason?
You can find me at jasoncordova.com. I don't update it very often, but randomly I will. I'm more active on X Twitter. I like memes. That's pretty much what I'm sharing. Occasionally, I'll show an ad to a book or something, but mostly I'm there for the memes.
Yeah,
And
meme farmer.
yeah,
It's
that's
honest
about it.
work.
David?
So davidboop.com is the easiest. I also have my company longshot-productions.net. But they go to the same place. I've been rebuilding my website over the last year. Pretty much there are pages for all my different series now. They're loose, but those videos I talked about are on there on the Hack the Well page. That's our branding for the Well World series is hashtag Hack the Well. You'll see the videos and find out about the permutations there. Plus all the other stuff that I work on, the weird westerns and sci-fi noirs and all of that. So, and I'm on every single social media because I've done Kickstarters and I have to promote things. So, yeah. David Boop. I'm the only David Boop author. There is another David Boop, but he's a doctor and he's really getting tired of the request to be in his anthologies. So
All right. Well, thank
Medical
everyone.
horrors.
And if you're considering making an anthology, watch this video and also check out all these websites. So thank you again and have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for the invite.
And now, as promised, one jump ahead. John Moore is a nanotech-enhanced soldier of fortune. Lobo is an AI, a living weapons and intelligence platform of enormous destructive potential. Two very dangerous wolves in a galaxy of deadly corporate and paramilitary predators. But Moore has grown weary of the killing, and just once he'd like to finish a job without leaving a trail of blood behind him. Not going to happen. Not on a pristine planet called Makan, where two gigantic corporations vie for control of the local jump gate and access to the riches of an undeveloped world. Dealing with a kidnapping and extortion scheme is only the beginning for Moore and Lobo as they work to stay one jump ahead.
But two of the doors were hanging loose, their rear supports trashed by either the mines or the landing. Second group returning to original course, Lobo said. Team two, assume the target is in your group. Team one, verify assumption. First the front and then the rear of the crashed vehicle exploded as Lim placed armor-piercing rounds in both areas that might house the main drive engines. Armor shielding around the cabin was standard executive protection, so the occupants should survive the small explosions. Sure enough, all five people spilled out of the back of the vehicle, using its rear doors and the heavy dust in the air for cover. One peeked around the door, and for that action earned a combo electrical disruptor and trank round in the meat of the shoulder. He dropped fast, twitching. Lim was as accurate as ever. The sound of my gate opening yanked me away from Lim's display relay. The escape group hit the exit point fast, and I blew half my mines. I planted them farther down the road than Lim, not trusting my accuracy as much as she did hers. The vehicle had been edging to the far right of the road, so the mines sent it spinning side over side into the air. It landed on its flank on the ground on the shoulder of the road opposite me, then righted itself. Both doors on my side sprang open, as did the rear door on the opposite side. The driver and the passenger nearest me spilled out and hid behind the vehicle as I shot an armor-piercing round into its front. These guys were fast. They fanned out to either side of the highway a moment after the front of the vehicle exploded. I switched guns, settled my breathing, and put a disruptor-slash-trank round into the shoulder of the guy on my side of the road because he was the nearer threat. He dropped hard, body twitching on the way down. I swiveled the sights to my left and found the second guy. He was running fast and erratically, making it hard. I squeezed off three shots in rapid succession. The third hit him and dropped him. I turned the sights on the open driver's door, but no one was inside. I scanned farther away from the car on the other side of the road and caught a glimpse of three figures running in a cluster, the front and rear each staying close to the center. The center had to be Chung. They disappeared behind some trees. All five down, Lim said, her voice jagged, pumped. Checking now. Three on the move, I said, my own voice as raw as Lim's, my breathing coming hard, opposite side of the road from me. Track if possible. I abandoned the sniper rifles. They were no good on the move, and sprinted across the highway, staying low, drawing a pistol loaded with disruptor rounds as I ran. I reached the vehicle's rear and used it for cover. I snaked up a video feed and panned it quickly across the area in front of me. All clear. I dashed to the tree nearest where the three runners had entered the woods, backed against it, and panned the video feed again. They had maybe 10 seconds of lead on me, but the woods weren't dense and the ground was flat, so I found the men as they were angling out and away from the estate. I flicked the acquire button on the video sensor, and my heads-up display gained a red tracking arrow. I took off on roughly the same course as the Zycheck trio, following the arrow, running for all I was worth. Status, I gasped, as I sprinted around trees, avoided some bits of undergrowth, and barreling through others. Lobo was to pick up the first of us to take down the assigned targets, then help the other person. If I didn't catch my runners, we'd be better off with all of us chasing, because we had to assume Zycheck security had learned of our attack the moment we started and had teams coming our way. Our window was closing. "Checked and confirmed," Lim said. "Target is not here. Repeat, target is not here." "Acquiring Team One now," Lobo said. I was gaining on the runners. Chung was almost certainly slowing them. The security guys both paid to stay with him no matter what. I pushed my pace, working to control my breathing, soaking in my own sweat, mentally cursing Lim yet again for the suit's inadequate climate control. The rear guard slowed, turned his shoulder, and threw something. I skidded into the back of the nearest large tree as a shrapnel grenade exploded in the air, blasting high-velocity shards of razor-sharp metal into the trees all around and in front of me. I lost 3 seconds to making sure all the shrapnel had found a home, then another couple as I snaked around a video feed to verify I could safely move. Anger coursed through me as I saw the damage the grenade had caused. It could have ripped me to shreds. If I'd permitted myself to bring lethal weapons at that moment, I would have drawn them. I needed Chung alive, but I didn't need him happy. I holstered the Trank pistol, pulled a screamer launcher from my rear pack, and sprinted after them. I could barely see them in the trees ahead of me, but the glimpse I got was enough. I forced off the suit's audio feeds, then fired the screamer over their heads and ran hard for them. I couldn't see the grenade's flight path, but I could tell when it neared them because they grabbed their ears and stumbled, then fell, as the intense pain shook their eardrums and heads. I crammed the launcher into a side pocket and fumbled with my pistol's holster as I ran. They were already getting up. I drew within 10 meters and stopped, aimed, fought the shaking in my arms, and fired 4 times, twice at each of the 2 men I could see, the center and rear runners. So many things happened in the next second that only later could I reconstruct what I'd seen. Lobo dropped from the sky 50 meters behind the runners, a side panel opened to reveal the upper half of Lim. The rear runner fell. The center man, still standing, clutched at the man in front of him. That man lifted and aimed a pistol at me. The upward motion of the pistol dominated my vision. I dove to the ground, not wanting to have to rely on the suit's armor if I could avoid it, and rolled to my right. I looked up in time to see the front man drop, then Lim wave from Lobo's open hatch. I scrambled up and ran to the remaining man. As I drew nearer, I verified it was Chung. I'd looked at images of his face too many times not to know it well.
This has been the Bane Free Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us at the heart of science fiction. Join us next week as Jeremy Comeau sits down with Mercedes Lackey and Veronica Guigari to talk about their novel, The Ship Who Dared. And we continue with more One Jump Ahead by Mark L. Van Name, Part 57. Score by Ruth Judkowitz.